When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Telling you, bro. What's been happening, bro?
Not too much.
Still hitting more Peggy O's.
Time to present in Louisville, Harold Bradley and his guitar.
Hey everybody, thanks for tuning in again. My guest today is a legend in the history of Nashville and a member of the original A-team of session musicians that created the Nashville sound, Mr. Harold Bradley. He is one of the most recorded guitarists in history, if not the most. He has session logs and union contracts that show all this stuff. He's played on thousands of recording sessions, but not just any old sessions and songs. I'm talking about some of the most iconic and timeless songs of all time, like Patsy Cline's Crazy, Roy Orbison's Only the Lonely, Crying, Tammy Wynette's Stand By Your Man, Loretta Lynn's Coal Miner's Daughter, so many, many others. But not just country. Harold lent his giant musical thumbprint to Elvis Presley. Remember Burl Ives, Have a Holly Jolly Christmas, every time Frosty the Snowman comes on? That's Harold. Battle of New Orleans, the intro and banjo? That's Harold. Brenda Lee's Jingle Bell Rock and Rock Around the Christmas Tree, on and on. In the 60s, Harold recorded three solo records, one of which you're listening to a track from now, and they're entitled Misty Guitar, Guitar for Lovers Only, and Bossa Nova Goes to Nashville. And 50 years later, they're still just gorgeous to listen to. They're musically amazing. Harold's playing some great chord melody, and all of this stuff was just impeccably arranged back then. His brother was the legendary producer Owen Bradley, and along with Owen, they were the original architects of country music. They opened the first studio in what is now known as Music Row. And I met Harold many years ago. We worked together with the great singer Slim Whitman, and I learned so many things from him that I think about all the time still. So I was just humbled and honored that he would take the time and come down and chat with me. And I asked our mutual friend Andy Reese, great guitar player, plays with the Time Jumpers, to sort of co-moderate. He's been friends with Harold for many, many years. Harold's now 92 years young, great memory, as sharp as ever. He tells us these amazing stories. And one little footnote I want to mention, Harold, you'll hear him mention a lot of people by first name. These were some of his, the A-team members that created all this sound together. And he's so humble, he doesn't like to give himself credit. He's very quick to pass on credit. But I know he regretted not having the list of all the names, but I have it, Harold. Here it is. These were the original 12 people that were inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame as the original A-team. So besides Harold, the other guitarists were Hank Garland, Ray Edmonton, Grady Martin, steel guitarist Pete Drake, fiddler Tommy Jackson, harmonica player Charlie McCoy, Bob Moore on bass, pianists Pig Robbins and Floyd Kramer, and drummer Buddy Harmon, and saxophonist Boots Randolph. All right, here we are stepping into the Nashville Musicians Union, and we're reserved a room and we're sitting there chatting. So hope you enjoy. I'm sitting in Nashville, Tennessee with legendary Harold Bradley and my other great friend, great guitar player, Andy Reese. And we're at the Nashville Musicians Union. I haven't been in here in, since I think we rehearsed together with Slim Whitman eons ago. But Harold, I just want to say I'm honored that you would do this and thank you for taking the time. And it's great to see you after all these years, you know.
Well, Shane, it's great to see you. And it's always great to see Andy. I have to be careful because he knows all my secrets.
Well, hopefully after this, other people will know your secrets. So,
I hope so.
And it's kind of special. I've never done one of these interviews with another kind of co-guest, and Andy is sort of co-moderate with me, I guess. I don't know, because I know you guys have been friends for so long. So I just, you know, wanted to talk to you about your career. I mean, just a little backstory, people listening. When I first moved to Nashville, I was probably 21, and one of the first gigs I got was with Slim Whitman, and that was because of Andy here, who graciously recommended me. I was just a long-haired rock and roll guitar player. And for some reason you liked me and hooked me up with some gigs, and I got to, next thing I know, I'm sitting next to Harold Bradley, who's, you know, one of the most recorded, if not the most recorded guitar player in session history, you know, and we'll get to all that.
Well, Shane, can I just mention that? When I was new in Nashville, I met Harold Bradley, and he recommended me for the Slim Whitman gig.
Wow. It's a generational thing, right?
Took him to Europe.
Well, I'll never forget a couple of things real quick, Harold. I was thinking back last night, making some notes, and I don't know if you'll remember this, but one thing I remember was us flying to Jackpot, Nevada, because I guess Slim thought, well, I'll use this kid, but, you know, Harold's going to be there first to train him. And we did, what was that tune? Blue Moon of Kentucky, like twin guitar.
Yeah.
Solo.
Oh, yeah.
And you had about six different kinds of picks on your pick stand, on the music stand. And you told me, now when it gets to this, you need to switch to this pick because it's a different tone. And I was thinking, I've never heard of such a thing. But
I'm still using that pick.
Really?
Yeah. It's a cutout.
Was that the shark fin?
The shark fin.
Shark fin.
Yeah.
And then I remember another time, I was telling Andy for lunch today, I remember flying with you once and we were sitting in adjacent aisle seats and this guy got up in the front of the plane, this long leather trench coat with a hat on, and you said, "Hey, Grady. And it was Grady Martin, another one of the original Nashville A-Team. And I was just like, how could I be in this spot? So anyway, I remember all that stuff and I think about it often, you know. So, well, I just want to show you this first. I'm pulling out this old, these old book of charts that I got from you. Look at that. This is your version of Laura's theme.
Oh,
Harold
yeah.
Bradley, there's your old chart with all your meticulous. Slim would change the arrangement every night and you'd rewrite the chart.
Yeah. We used to take bets on whether he'd go to the bridge or not.
Right. Slim was a great talent and a great guy. I remember us working the Corn Exchange in England. And we were sitting there, and the crowd was a little buzzy, you know. And he walked up to the mic, and he sang really softly. Mm-hmm. And the place got so silent, you could hear a pin drop. I think you were there, Andy.
Yes.
It was a real lesson to me, because other people get up there and sing their guts out, thinking singing loud is singing, you know. But it was a real lesson to watch a guy get up there and a very nice modulated voice sing something really soft and tender, and everybody just quit doing what they were doing.
Wow.
He impressed me.
I got to go to England with him a few times. Yeah, there was some early lessons.
And he had a quiet charisma where he was one of those guys who walks into the room and everybody looks at him just automatically.
Yeah.
Yep, you're right.
And some of those guitar parts that you played on the record, Harold, I had to learn via Andy, and I remember trying to cop some of those things, and I had a lot of chops, but I didn't have necessarily a lot of finesse. Slim would turn around to me and goes, "It's so simple, it's hard, isn't it?"
that was a lesson.
You know?
That was true, absolutely true.
I have a favorite guy behind me, too. Met him in 1949. He was my leader then. In fact, I moved from Florida to Nashville then, and we became very good friends. Part of it could have been he had a car and I didn't. He's quite a musician. If you've heard a record, you've probably heard him on the record. He's been on 90% of mine. He would have been on the other 10%, but I did some here and some all over the world. His wife wouldn't let him fly and he couldn't swim, so he stayed home. He's moving up. He's coming in, and the show goes on. Here's Harold Bradley. Harold Bradley.
But Harold, you've played with so many people and recorded. What was your first session you ever did in Nashville?
Well, let's back up. The first record session that I ever did, period, was 1946 in Chicago with Pee Wee King. Wow. Because there were no studios in Nashville.
Really?
The next year, 1947, my brother called me and said, we're going to do this jingle at Castle. It was the first commercial recording studio in Nashville. And so we went in, and Snooky Lanson was the vocalist, and it was only bass, guitar, drums, and piano. And we did this jingle. And that was the first session at a commercial studio in Nashville.
Wow.
Was the Castle then?
It was in the Tulane Hotel at 8th and Church. And it was used to be the ballroom, direct to disc.
Wow.
They had a tape thing that they didn't believe in it for sure, that the Germans had invented, but it was direct to disc. And I got paid $17 for it.
Wow.
And my brother and I were starting in the studio business. We had our first studio. And I'd go home and play the radio, and I'd hear myself on the radio going home. I thought, boy, I really made it. They had $17, and they played it for 17 years. You know? But really, the most interesting one was the one with Pee Wee King, was Western Swing. And I should have quit then, because I think I played some nice things. I didn't know what I was doing at all.
I must go when I hear that whistle blow on the Tennessee Central number 9.
I was a radioman, but we had a little band, and we were just playing pop songs, but all of a sudden we were doing some stuff, and I had all the technique I needed, because they play pretty fast, you know. But I should have brought you a copy of that, you know, because it was...
I will get it.
Who else was playing on that?
Well, the amazing thing was the electric guitar was new. And he had a guy that played fiddle and electric guitar, Red Stewart, who also wrote the Tennessee Waltz with him.
Wow.
But Red couldn't play them both at the same time. Uh-huh. So he hired me to just supplement the band. And so I got to go, and it took us 2 or 3 trips to do an album, you know.
Hey, the Southland Polka, it's the kind of dance we're doing down in Dixie. Southland polka, it's the only tune we dance to every night.
In 1943, my brother called me. I wasn't doing much. Wasn't any much going on here in the town. He said, why don't you go on the road with Ernest Tubb this summer? His guitar player just quit with an ulcer. And I said, what, and play that old corny country music? That's just exactly.
Playing body and soul. You don't
I thought I was above that. And he said, it'll do you good. Mm. I went on the road with him to New Orleans, railroad the train, standing up during the war. And somebody come by selling sandwiches every once in a while, finally got there. But I learned a lot about country music. I learned to appreciate it. And Ernest and I were lifelong friends. I played on a lot of his records later on. Mm. But no, I didn't appreciate country music. I really didn't. There wasn't that many people playing the electric guitar. When I was playing in 1943, I was kind of a freak because I was 17 and I'm playing electric guitar, which is a new instrument to people, you know. And it was, I didn't think anything about it. It was just great fun. But back then, if anybody made the mistake, start all over again, you know. And that wasn't too bad if the record's only 2 minutes and 30 seconds.
Right.
But when we were doing transcriptions here with Owen's 35-piece band, radio band, if the trumpet player blew a note, the announcer blew a note, the singer blew a note, they called a 15-minute break, and everybody cried, went had a cup of coffee, came back. It didn't matter where you were in the transcription. If you were 30 minutes in, then you'd start at the top. So that was so being able to not do that was a blessing, but that's one of the reasons the A-team, the 12 guys I worked with, were around a long time, is because we had to memorize the songs. We didn't have any music. And this was before the number system came to be in Nashville. And we could do that at the same time that the singer was giving his top performance.
Right.
And so I think that's one of the reasons A-team was around for a long time. Once we settled in, those 12 guys, they knew how to color inside the, you know, the lines.
Don't that tickle you?
You were doing sessions, and at the peak, you were doing sessions around the clock, right? Didn't you hear once that you'd sleep in the studio and start over a couple of times? It was, how many sessions were you doing a week?
Well, I wish I'd have brought that. I could have showed you some of my logs. I've got some of them going way back. But what you're talking about, Tommy Tedesco on the West Coast was always listed in Guitar Player magazine as the most recorded guitar player. And then Rich Kinzel up in Northeast, I've never met him, told him, said, you better be careful. This guy down in Nashville may be the most recorded guy. So they sent a guy here, and he looked at my logs. Mm. He said, well, yeah, you are the most recorded guitar player at that time when there was, because Tommy Tedesco couldn't do more than like a couple of sessions because of geography. Couldn't go from studio to studio, you know, to get two sessions a day. Right. We did four sessions a day, and occasionally we did five, and that's what you're talking about. Because an artist would come to the studio and say, I got to cut this session this week. And we said, we're booked four sessions a day, you know, do it next week. Now I'm in Podunk next week, can't do it next week. So we'd put a session in starting after we finished at 1 o'clock in the morning and end up in I'd sleep in the drum booth. It saved me an hour going home and an hour coming back. But we didn't do that all the time, but we did do it, and it really wasn't that much fun. It kind of prepared me for working with Elvis, because I was looking in the logbook the other day, and one of the sessions we did with him, we started 8 o'clock Sunday night, ended up 8 o'clock Sunday morning.
Elvis liked to work all night?
Yeah, and he went and had breakfast, went to sleep. I had breakfast, went and played a couple more sessions.
Wow.
we did an album in that night, three sessions.
What was he like to work with? Nice guy?
He was wonderful. Yeah, he was really nice. I really liked him. I did one song that... because there's a pecking order, and I respect that. my friend Hank Garland got hurt, and so I kind of moved in there. But I'm still like the second or the third guitar player on the session, and you really don't assert yourself if you're not the leader. You know, you have Scotty, and I respected him because I love what he did. He was a real pioneer rock and roll guitar player.
Scotty was, yeah.
Yeah, he really was. And as you careful about the suggestions you make or whatever, but I took Hank's place, I guess you could say, and I played the Tic Tac bass guitar on one of the first ones. And later on, as the years went by, I walked into the studio one day, and I looked around, and it was Chip Young and me. And Chip's a really great rhythm guitar player, so I knew it was me. We did a song he really liked called Indescribably Blue, and I'm playing the gut string guitar all over that. Mm. It's like me and Elvis, you know. He's on my record. Wow. But he really liked it, and it's the only time that I really got a chance to really assert anything with Elvis.
Our friends all ask me the last time I saw you. I smile and tell them.
I mean, your memory is so sharp. I mean, you can remember these things, and it's like I'm there sitting with you. I mean, if you mentioned Roy Orbison. You got any Roy Orbison stories? Or?
Well, before him, let's try to start back at the beginning.
Okay.
Patsy Cline.
Yeah, obviously.
I played all of her hits.
Right.
I played on all of her bombs. It was 90% bombs until she had the hits. And we did Crazy. And we didn't have any music, and after three hours, she couldn't sing the song. After 4 hours, an hour overtime, my brother said, well, don't you beating yourself up. She'd had an automobile wreck and broke her ribs, and it was one note that she couldn't hold out.
Wow.
And so we made a track without any headphones, without her singing it, and I have to say that's a great track.
And that's what ended up being the classic.
Yeah.
Track.
And my brother said she came back within 2 weeks and sang it all the way through one time. He said, when she got through, neither one of us wanted to do it again.
Wow.
That was unusual. An hour overtime, he only got a track. And we were very lucky because the stereo had just come in, but the middle track was open. And so her voice is in the middle track, the band split on each side. Mm. And, I view that in Crying as some of the great songs that I've played on.
Absolutely.
Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling so lonely. I'm crazy, crazy for feeling.
Forward, some I hate to skip Brenda Lee.
We don't have to skip anything. You can talk about anything you want.
Well, we got her when she was about 11 or 12, and you ought to go back and listen to some of that early stuff. She's hiccuping and doing all kinds of stuff. I don't know who she could have been copying if she was, but she was very talented, and we feel like we raised her. But we were doing a session one day, and we played the intro, and she didn't come in. And my brother said, Brenda, what's wrong? She said, the bass player missed a note. And we did I'm Sorry, which was a huge hit, and she still can hang her head on that. And my brother didn't take credit. He wouldn't take credit for anything, but he actually did like one of the Inkbox deals. There's no chorus on I'm Sorry. So he did a verse And then he modulated and did the verse, then he modulated and did another verse. So, and then he actually did some talking on there, some recitation, you know. Mm. And you listen to those early records, and you'll hear that some of the groups that were doing them back then. No, I don't want to miss her. I guess we move on to Roy. Roy was a nice guy. I never heard him raise his voice. Of course, he started in Wink, Texas. He went over to Memphis like three or four other guys did and started there and then came to Nashville and had their hits. I can't explain that because we couldn't do that for one of the guys. But all the other guys came over, and Roy did record some in Memphis. Then he came over here, and I think the first session I played on with him was a hit.
Only the Lonely.
Oh, yeah. Wow, I didn't know you played on that.
Yeah,
wow.
Played the tic-tac bass guitar.
Only the lonely know the way I feel tonight.
Scared that Valero thing, because it's just Roy Orbison starting out.
Just running scared. Each place we go.
But then, crying, he came over and he said, "Harold, I want you to play this." So he made a D chord, an open D chord, you know, ringing. Well, I was coming out of the orchestra, you know. So without thinking about it, I played one close, you know, pum, 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 pum. That's it. I didn't know that was it. But he said, "That's it. Okay. So Roy and Buddy Harmon, the drummer, and I start crying, pum, 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 you know. And then he comes in, and Fred Foster had gotten him to write this song in a Bolero beat. And so it's just Roy and I for about 16 bars, I don't know, long ways in there. Bum, 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 bum. Because I have a wonderful guitar. It's a Stromberg.
Wow.
That was built for me, and it has a very wonderful sound. I cherish those, and I cherish working with Roy because he was very calm, and when he was getting hits, he came in and would have these ideas and tell us what he wanted us to play, because he's a pretty fair guitar player himself, but he never tried to play on the sessions, but he would show you things, you know, and during all the time that he was successful, he would come in, and that was like his formula. But once he changed record companies, and they started putting arrangers in, and the last session I did with him was right across the alley, and Jerry Kennedy produced it, and we started out writing a number system, you know, and we wrote down the song, and then we started playing it, and then he would skip two or three beats here and there, so like that. I wish I had that chart. And then we got through, and finally got it recorded, but that wasn't the way he worked when he was successful. Mm. He knew exactly what he wanted and how he wanted it, but to come in and just randomly start off the cuff and then bring in an arranger. What's so strange about the hits that he had was on Crying, Running Scared, and Only the Lonely, three different arrangers. And I thought that was remarkable.
Wow.
It was Anita Kerr, Jim Hall, and I can't remember the other guy's name. The guitar player was here. I'm sorry, I can't remember his name. because he deserves the credit, but yeah. The bio, and you'll find his name there. I just think that's remarkable that they could, once they got the sound, mm-hmm. one of them, somebody knew what they wanted. And Blue Bayou, I mean, nobody's come along to take his place.
Right. A classic voice. Howard, for those listening, tell me if I'm wrong, but the way I understood a tic-tac bass is that it was originally, because you couldn't reproduce the sound of an upright low end on the speaker, so you would reinforce it with play with a pick, and it would double the bass. Is that right?
Well, yes. What happened was in 1958, Hank Garland went down to Strobel's music store and came to a session, and he brought this strange-looking instrument. It was a black one. And we tried different Greg and Hank. I think they played on sessions before I did. And then it's really a six-string guitar, you know, with,
right.
But it's also a four-string bass on the bottom with two extra strings above that. It's a weird instrument, very poorly made, won't tune, no way to tune. You just have to tune whatever key in with the bass. And fortuitous thing that I did was I put my hand over the bridge and it got a note, it got a click, and my brother loved it. He used it until he died on his last session. He liked it because on the transistor radio, when the bass would drop out in the early days, he'd still have a note, and he'd have that click. And with the click like that, I had studied bass in college, so I had the left-hand position, kind of a triad, triangle.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of had that in my mind. And we started working on the bass lines, and you can double the bass. And then also, because it having that click and then a higher register, you can play a lot of extraneous other notes that you couldn't get away with if you did it on the bass, sound like a cannon going off.
Mm-hmm.
But you could play boom, ba da da da. It took a while for Bob Moore and I to get together, the bass player who did the most sessions here. And I give him a lot of credit for one thing that he did. He wouldn't let you change keys without playing the tonic twice or the mm-hmm. whatever key you were in.
Right. Before you, know, you like approach to a four chord.
C, G, C, C, F, F. You know, he established that because the bass players before that played tonic and fifth everywhere.
It's wishy-washy.
And the bass would drop out. The early records we had, it would drop out completely on some notes because they weren't as good a player and the bass wasn't as even. Players even now in F sharp.
Right.
G-flat, whichever you prefer. It's pretty rowdy when you're getting that key for upright bass players. And when you play C, you know, on the third string, and then you play G open, it's boom, boom. It pings out like that, unless you got some way of controlling it. And Bob Moore had a way of controlling it. He had it all even notes in D-flat. It'd be fine. Didn't matter. And that's a blessing.
Is it Johnny Horton? 1814, we took a look. Didn't you play on that?
I played the banjo
on
that.
You played the banjo on that.
And unfortunately, that banjo was stolen. That's the greatest banjo I had. Couldn't replace it. But there's one thing about that. There's a couple of things about it. I played it banjo tuning because I had played in Papa John Gordy's Dixieland band.
Oh, the real
so
deal.
So it's played in banjo tuning. Mm-hmm. And because to play the notes that I'm playing, you'd have to play them up here, you know. But with a banjo tuning, what's the first one is an A, and it's a lot higher. And mm-hmm. so it had a great sound. Sonically, his records, I was listening to one of his the other day that sounded really great. It was Oh, For the Love of a Girl. And as you always do, you volunteer to play something to So I volunteered to ask Don Law, I said, and Grady, I said, hey, I got this new instrument. What do you think about this? It was a tipple, 10 strings. And they said, oh, yeah, that sounds good. Well, it did sound good. But when I started trying to play that thing on the record, I'm holding all those strings down. I thought, oh, my God, what have I done? I don't have any calluses for 10 strings, you know. But I got through it. And then, you know, thought about throwing it away, but it was stolen before I could throw it away.
In 1814, we took a little trip along with Colonel Jackson down the mighty Mississippi. We took a little bacon and we took a little beans, and we caught the bloody British in a town in New Orleans. We fired our guns and the British kept a coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while.
What kind of equipment did you bring? Your own amps to the? Or did they have house amps back then at these studios, or what were you using on all these sessions, Harold?
Well, when I came out of the Navy, I was playing through a Bogan PA set, and it burned. I drove by the nightclub on the school bus one morning, and it had burned down. But I took my guitar home. I didn't take the amp. So back then, right after the war, they didn't make amps, but. Now, we had to carry amps, and but it didn't have any effects, no echo, no tremolo, nothing like that, you know. It was only when Ray Butts put the tape slapback in Chet's amp and Scotty Moore's amp.
The Echosonic.
Echosonic.
Wow.
As opposed to the Echophonic. You got it, Andy. And we weren't the lucky ones. No effects rack, you know. No echo, no nothing like that. It was just plug it in and play it, you know. And that bar pickup still sounds pretty good.
Talking about his Gibson ES-150 with the Charlie Christian pickup.
That's in this interview. You're talking about that. That it's a little Guitar Player magazine I was reading. Yeah, so you still have that guitar?
Yeah, I do. I bought it from Billy Bird. It's a great sounding guitar even now.
You still have your Ventura?
Yeah, I do.
I remember that guitar.
Yeah. Yeah, I do have that one. Yeah.
And then you had one called a Bradley.
Yeah. The Japanese thought that was a famous name, I guess. So they put some out like that for a while. Actually, it was a pretty good guitar, and it wasn't as heavy as the Les Paul. Uh-huh. I couldn't play the Les Paul standing up. It's so heavy. But it was lighter.
I also love that track, the Leon Russell, when he had his pseudonym,
Hank Wilson's
back.
Rolling in My Sweet Baby's Arms. You played on that too, right?
Well, that's a good story too, because we did it at Bradley's barn, my brother's barn, and he actually spliced that cut.
Wow.
Yeah. We did it slow, and then we did like some faster version with Charlie McCoy, somebody playing the harp. He took him back to Tulsa, Oklahoma, wherever he was, and spliced it together.
Wow.
And it sounded great. It was perfect, you know, but when we left the studio, it didn't sound like that. I think a lot of the people kind of bought into the notes that we were playing, the run-ups, da-da-da-da, different things like that. Although Archie Blyer said, Floyd Kramer, play that. And then he said, well, it clashes with the pickups. Well, if it's down low, it doesn't clash with anything. But we didn't bother to try to educate Archie Blyer, you know. So we didn't play the pickups, and it sounded weird to us, because that's the way we're leading the singers in.
I see.
You know. Oh, my God. It was a marvelous time, because we were making it up. We're not sure what we were doing, but after a while, we did know what we were doing with different artists, because they say the Nashville sound No, it's plural. Nashville Sounds, because Ernest Tubb had his sound, Brenda had her sound, different people had their sounds, you know. And when the radio came on with the intro, you'd say, well, that's Ernest Tubb. Or you'd say, well, that's Brenda Lee. Or you'd say, it's Patsy Cline. But I don't think it's that way now. It's we've lost the country music art form, but that's another debate. Take, for instance, my brother. Somebody asked him, why didn't you sign your own brother? He said, oh, I wouldn't let him do those old standards like that. It's the only time I know he was wrong, because actually on the strength of those three albums I gave you.
Your three records, it's Misty Guitar.
Guitar for Lovers Only.
And the Bossa Nova goes to Nashville.
I was number nine in 1966.
Wow.
In the Billboard poll. And without doing anything, I didn't plan on going on the road. I couldn't take that orchestra with me.
Right.
But I started with Floyd Kramer, and that awful to be tied with such a wonderful artist. But my biggest kick was somebody brought me Northwest Orient Airlines playlist, you know. And they had What's New in the Jazz category with Ella Fitzgerald and Count Basie. And that was a big kick, really.
Wow.
It was. What you'd say. But when I got to the session, Bill McAlhine, the arranger, had everything written out. He'd heard me play, you know. And then he came over and he said, oh, by the way, Phil here. As if I wasn't doing enough, you know. And so I tried to play a few little jazz runs to keep everybody awake in between playing the melody, you know. And also I heard a lot of guitar players there playing single notes. The orchestra was working real hard. And then I heard Johnny Smith, and I couldn't play what he did, so I tried to play full chords as much as I could, you know.
What are some of your favorite tracks off those albums? If you had to think about a few highlights, the ones that you really like.
Well, the first track is a theme from Exodus. It's close to jazz, you know. Mm-hmm. It is. That's what I was trying for with that. But there are two technical things in there that I really like. One's Sugarfoot Rag on the 12 string.
Wow, that's hard to play.
Well, no overdubs on the three albums I did. No overdubs.
Wow.
But there's one called the Petite Waltz that I never want to play again. It goes da 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 da. And I was playing it just great. And they put Grady where Andy is. And he's playing the thing we learned from Burl Ives, and it's not the same thing. It's, if you listen to it on the record, it's all over the place, you know. Put him there, and, you know, and I agonized, but I played it one time through, and I never want to try to play it again. I asked Boots Randolph, I said, Boots, play this part with me. He said, I can't. Boots Randolph never said I can't about anything. He was playing that little... a small horn, you know. And I said, why? He said, there's no place for me to breathe. Well, Bill McAlhany went over to Bill Purcell, who was playing organ, wrote the part out. Bill Purcell sight read it and played harmony when I played it.
Wow.
One time through, you know.
Wow.
Hey, you have to admire a guy like that, you know, because, I mean, it wasn't a melody. I'm playing da 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 da. He's playing harmony to it. So that's one that I'm really proud of, to get through it.
My favorite track on Misty Guitars is your version of Laura.
That's got some really... hard things in there. That's one place where I do play an octave, da da da, all the way down. That was hard.
That's beautiful.
Well, I was a fool to think I could do it in front of an orchestra, you know. But you know, you get pumped up, and I was just—I love that cut, by the way.
It's great.
Thank you. I like it.
Of sessions with Chet Atkins, like both of you playing together?
No,
like that.
No, I worked for him. I did play some sessions at his house, and he did an album there. I'm glad you mentioned Chet, because he's one of my favorite people, as is my brother, because my brother is really the big daddy of the music business in Nashville.
Owen Bradley, for those that, yeah.
Right, and he and Chet were great friends. They were competitors, but they never thought of being competitors. Because they knew that if one of them got a hit, like Perry Como not recording for years, coming down here and doing Dream on Little Dreamer, that it was going to bring more business to Nashville. Mm-hmm. They were good businessmen, too, you know, but they were great friends. But they had different styles in producing. Owen had a group of guys he used on the last session that he did, the ones that hadn't passed away. He got locked into the A team, and that's who he wanted and who he used, because he knew how to beat us up, you know. And Chet was a different thing. Chet hired different people, and he got great results. But I walked in one day, and I think it was a Jim Reeves session, and we're standing around listening to the first song, learning it, you know, kind of listening to it. Everybody gets ready to go, and he says, Harold, he says, we really don't need another guitar on this. Go over and play vibes.
Wow. Vibes.
Did you play vibes?
Yeah. Well, I had just enough knowledge to play three notes, and we were playing three chords. And he did that to Charlie McCoy and Boots Randolph, too, you know. But here's what he would do. You'd be playing, and sometimes he'd be in there practicing the classical guitar, and he'd push the playback up, and he'd know exactly what was going wrong. And then other times he'd be in the midst of us when we learned the songs, and he would do a playback, and he said, play something else. We said, okay. So then you'd play something you thought was really good. He'd come back out, and you'd say, how was that? And he'd say, not bad. But you loved him for it, because he was so nice. But they got great results, I'll tell you. Both of them doing absolutely different methods. Yeah.
I know you worked with Willie Nelson, but was that when Willie was here in Nashville in the early 60s, or was that later?
It was 1961, and my friend Joe Allison signed him, and I was his leader. And we drove around trying to figure out what to put behind him. Yeah, because of the way he phrased everything. So we figured the best thing we'd do was stay out of his way. So we had a couple of top 10 hits. It was on Liberty Records, 1961. Got on other labels. He was on everybody's label. Chet recorded him and didn't have any luck. And different people recorded him. But there was a songwriter named Hank Cochran, an excellent songwriter. I'm not going to name all his songs because I can't. I went to a memorial service at his house, and Jeannie Seeley got up and talked while the singer from the Grand Ole Opry, a country singer, and she said that Willie and Hank met somewhere, and when they said, well, I got it figured out. I write the positive and you write the negative. I write touch me and you write don't touch me. And Hank said, well, you hear goodbye walls. Well, it was hello walls.
Hello walls. That's the one I'm talking about.
Around.
Yeah, he turned around.
He turned around.
But hello walls. I know that tune, hello walls. That's Jordan Ayers singing on that stuff, probably.
Yeah, hello.
Yeah, that's
hello.
Right.
Hello.
Hello.
Nice to see you again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was one of his early hits.
Did you play on that session, Hal? Did you play on that?
No, I didn't. Yeah. I think it was Fair and Young. And it would have been Ken Nelson.
Wow, I don't know how you remember all this stuff. I can barely remember last week. That's amazing. Yeah. I mean, it is really amazing. Wow.
Well, I have a little trouble with some things.
Well,
but basically, I still remember a lot.
Yeah.
But really, it all goes back to the song. If you don't have a song, don't go in the studio. Hmm. I've tried to put everything in the world behind singers that weren't up to snuff, and you can't improve it because it's the loudest thing you hear on the radio. You play it in your car radio, and the voice is going to be, if you can't change that, then you can't overproduce it. And really, you don't really have to sing in tune. Like Chris Christopherson on Why Me Lord proved that, you know. But you have to have the feeling, but you have to have the song.
I have to have the song.
Yeah. Have the song. What's the secret of my success? It's really the guys that I was surrounded by, the A-team, the musicians. But then you have to put the singers first. It was never about me, except on those albums. When you walk in the door, you leave the ego there, and you go in, and gave Charlie McCoy his medallion for the Hall of Fame, going to the Country Music Hall of Fame. And I said, Charlie learned right off what you have to do to be a session musician. The artist is always right. The artist is never wrong. Mm. And that's what it is.
Wherever, really. I
was listening the other day to a record you did with one of your good friends, Don Gibson, and it was the album
Gibson Guitars and Girls.
That's the one. So that was you and
Johnny Smith and Hank Garland.
Wow.
But it was all arranged. It was all three-part guitar stuff. How did that come to be?
It was all written. It was Gut String Guitars,
and
Nita Kerr wrote it. And I don't know how Roy Hangarlan learned it. I really don't, unless Anita taught him the parts, because he really couldn't read very well at all.
But you were a good reader, and Johnny Smith was obviously a good reader.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Johnny was a beautiful guy and a great player. And we did that album, and then Hank got hurt. So they came back to do another album like that, and then it was Grady and me and Johnny. But Grady couldn't read it after the first session, he quit.
Wow.
And then we brought in the guy that I couldn't remember his name while I go, and I'm sorry I can't, because he could read it. And he wanted to do, play with our fingers. And Johnny said, not up to that. But Johnny played some beautiful solos on that. And
how did Johnny Smith come to be on that?
I'm glad you asked that, because he and Chet had become friends. And about before Johnny died, about a year before he died, I called him and talked to him, and we revisited that session. He said that there was one period in his life he cut part of his finger off or something, that if it hadn't been for Chet, he had had a hard time feeding his family. But he and Chet were great friends. Actually, he let Don arrange, Johnny arrange something. I've never heard it because they didn't release that next album. They didn't release that one. I love Johnny. The first time he was here, we all went down to Carousel so he could hear Hank and Sid in, you know. And Hank was playing Lights Out, you know. And Johnny wouldn't play for a couple of hours. And he finally got up and played. And so we were doing the second session. Secretary from RCA poked her head in the door and said, hey, said, somebody just called on the phone. I don't know if y'all are going to have another jam session down at the Carousel like you did last time. And Johnny Smith said, not after the way Hank Garland chopped me up.
Wow.
How can you not like a guy like that, you know? Yeah. He was beautiful. He really was.
I'm just a driftwood on the river, floating down the tide. I don't care where this old river carries me. I keep drifting.
Chet was too, because he recorded people that had talent, but he knew they weren't going to make it. But he recorded them, or he'd have somebody else like Danny Davis record them. And I'm thinking of Paul Buskirk. He ended up being Willie Nelson's great friend. He was my friend when I played the Grand Ole Opry in 1943. Yeah, with Ernest Tubb.
Wow.
Billy Bird was my mentor, and he was hooked on Charlie Christian. So I'm starting out at 12 years old, and he's showing me Charlie Christian stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll play rhythm behind him, and he'll hand me the arms. You play. Didn't show me to hold a pick, do anything, just you play, you know. So I learned a lot of that stuff. And we'd play Body and Soul in the dressing room at the Grand Ole Opry. We taught it to one bass player. And I thought everybody knew that song. I really did. You know. And we'd play it. And then everybody come in the restroom room and listen. Paul Buskirk came in and played mandolin. He could play it with us, you know. But it shows how ignorant you are when you're young. But I didn't know any better. You know, I just thought everybody knew that song because Bill had pushed it so much and everything. Because anytime he wanted a jam or anything like that, how about Body in Five Flats?
I've talked to Billy about the impact that Charlie Christian had on him when he first heard him and how monumental that was. But I'm curious, because a lot of people are really crediting Django Reinhardt now with being a large influence. Were you guys hearing Django at that point in time?
No, not really. I heard him a little later, but I was never able to copy one lick off of Django. And Charlie Christian didn't copy anything off of Django. It's so different styles, absolutely different.
What about George Barnes? Were you guys aware of him at all?
Yeah, because I heard him when I was just a kid. He played Little Rock Getaway, clean as it could be, and that really impressed me. You know, he was such a clean player.
Because George doesn't get a lot of credit, but he was a very active jazz electric guitar player around the same time Charlie Christian was.
In all honesty, I don't think he had the impact.
No, he didn't.
But he was a technical genius. That's what I thought of him when I heard him play that. And he was a great guitar player. You're right, he doesn't get enough credit for being a jazz player. But Charlie had so much soul and everything. I mean, I remember still part of the solo in Rose Room that Billy and I learned a long time ago.
I'm going to ask you something maybe nobody's ever asked you before, but I'm just curious. Did in all the sessions you've done, did you ever lose your temper or see somebody just storm out of a session like a player? I mean, you seem like you've always been the most patient and professional. I'm just wondering if somebody, you don't have to name the artist, but if it happened, like, did you ever just lose your cool and just say, I'm out of here?
No, you weren't allowed to do that. There were a couple of times that I hyperventilated. I went to do this session, and I love the guy, the A&R man. Gut string guitar had everything. It started with like this on the first three strings. It's called Dear God with Roy Clark. It started there, but the guy playing it, Chris Gentry, wrote Dreams of an Everyday Housewife. He tuned the A string and the D string to different tunings.
Oh.
And of course, the A&R man didn't know that. And all of a sudden, I'm there, and that's what I'm going to play, you know, sooner or later.
Right.
But I did learn it, you know, and I played it with Roy, and it changing the bass notes, like, just, I did it perfectly. It took 3 hours for us to get that song. It wasn't me, it was trying to put it together, because the song really wasn't there. It just started out with Dear God.
Promise never to possess, hoard, or hold. Let me be of need.
It's a love song, but it's not the kind of hillbilly love song we're used to. But actually, when I got through with that, I went to a session with Sonny James, like at 10 o'clock, and I was hyperventilating, I'm telling you. That's all I could do, keep him falling out of the chair. And then later on, I heard the record, and the way they mixed it, the guitar wasn't up because it was a duet with a voice.
Oh.
I said, oh,
all that for nothing.
Yeah. But I did it. Another time, I went into a session with Al Hurt, 12 pieces of 15, I don't know. The big RCA studio here. And the first song up was Mission Impossible. And for a while, I thought it was going to be Mission Impossible. Because I was trying to kind of think, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Oh, boom, hot
time. Boom, 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 boom. It did that for about 30 bars, and then it deviated from that. And I couldn't count it, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So I just memorized, bum, 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 and counted the bars till I got down to where it deviated and made it through that. And there was no overdubbing at that time. They didn't have the, if you messed up, it would have really been messed up. I don't know what they would have done. So I got through that. I think, well, I'm not going to faint yet, you know. But it was another one where it was, I mean, it's thrown at you. People don't realize you go in, it's cold turkey. You haven't heard the songs and everything. So the next song up was Promises, Promises, with all the different time changes of Burt Bacharach, whoever did it, you know. Even the intro had 3 or 4 time changes. We got through that, and we got to, Taste of Honey, and I was thrilled.
4-4.
Yes. 4-4. Yeah, I may be able to make lunch after all.
What about Lenny Bro, Harold? What was your? I know you were friends, right?
Well, we were friends. We weren't great friends like I was with Chet, because I couldn't go all down to the alley and jam all night.
Mm-hmm.
But he's really undersung as a guitar player. I think he's marvelous. And he and Chet were great friends. See, that's why I admire Chet. I sent Jerry Reed to him, and Chet didn't say, go, little boy. He said, oh, I like that. And then they ended up playing duets together. Lenny Bro was the same way. Became great friends with him, and he said, oh, this guy's the greatest guitar player in the world. Mm-hmm. Heard him say that at one of the shows, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They were playing solo duets, you know, instrumentals. He was always willing to give credit to other guitar players. He'd walk in his office, probably the first thing he'd say is, play me a lick, you know. You know? He was a good person, you know. And he helped people, which I really admired, you know. I mean, I've even played Tire Chains on a record, you know. And Floyd Kramer played the hammer on Big Bad John. After an hour and a half or something, they go over to Floyd and say, we don't need piano in this, we need something like a miner's pick striking the coal. They took a big mic thing, and he's hitting it with a hammer. Chips are flying out of it. So finally they put it up on a stand. Some way they got it on a mic stand, you know. And he's hitting it like this, you know, pieces are flying off. And years later, I toured with Floyd, and we were playing in Virginia. And Jimmy Dean, Floyd said, hey, Jimmy Dean's coming over. Come on in the dressing room when you get over to the venue. I said, okay. So I went in, and Jimmy was there, and I played him Big Bad John. And so Jimmy came. He was introduced by Floyd. And he introduced his wife and let her do a song. And Jimmy kind of took over for a while. And he talked about, said, well, I know that I'm the only guy that Floyd Kramer ever played hammer for.
Hammer-ons.
Hammer, yeah. So you really try to do whatever they want you to do, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like Owen said, you stand on your head, do a few tricks like the dog, then they don't like that one, so you roll over.
There's your advice for musicians listening right there.
Big John, Big John,
Big Bad John,
Big John,
Big John. Is there anything else you want to talk about, Harold?
Well, I can just give you a couple of things, a couple of quotes, not for me. I haven't come up with a quote yet, but this friend of mine asked Les Paul, what advice would he give to young guitar players? Mm. And Les said, practice, practice, practice. There's always somebody better than you. Mm. And then I love what Chet said. He said, if I don't practice one day, I know it. If I don't practice 2 days, you know it. If I don't practice 3 days, the world knows it. Mm. And I guess that's the way it goes, isn't it?
Truth to that.
I'm sorry? Oh, yeah. Well, there is. It really is. It really is. But I would say play in all the different bands you can, because I was really lucky. I may not be the best guitar player, but I may be the most versatile guitar player. I played on Bunny Hop and the Hokey Pokey with Ray Anthony's big band. I played on Papa John Gordy's Dixieland Band playing banjo and ukulele on Honeymoon Feeling and Ray Stevens' record of a variety of things.
Sure.
That you talked about the car, I mean the instruments. I was driving Chevrolets and it had a huge trunk. I had 12 instruments in there and the amp in on the back seat. And when they went to smaller size, I had to take couple of instruments out, because I mean we carried everything, you know.
Well, I remember how in this parking lot at the Union years ago, you had a Cadillac, and I was helping you get stuff out the trunk, and I moved some jumper cables, and there was the six string bass, and you said, "That's the bass I used on Pat's." I said, "It doesn't even have a case; it was just in the trunk."
It still doesn't have a case. I still have it. And people really want to buy it.
It should be in the Smithsonian or your Country Music Hall of Fame, at the least, you know. It's, you know, I just left Andy's house. He's got about eight empty cases sitting in his front room. Maybe he'd give you one of those.
It's a good start.
that's the empty ones.
I was doing an interview at RCAA the other day. Of course, felt kind of strange walking in there after all the grief they gave me, you know. But went in, there's two nice historians there, and all of a sudden this guy comes up, and he's the guy running RCA now, David Cobb. And I guess that's the reason I was in there, because they were friends with him. But he wanted to interview me, too. I mean, it wasn't that obvious. But we were talking, you know, about just like we're talking now. And he said, well, I don't let my guys use cord seats. And I said, well, that's the way we started out. We didn't have any cord seats on Patsy Cline's records. Mm. He said, no, if I can't memorize it in 2.5 minutes, you know. And I wasn't going to debate him. But when I became the leader on a lot of sessions, I found out I'd saved about 15 minutes if everybody was playing the same chords. And back then, a guy would write a verse, and in the second verse, it would be a different set of chords. And it actually saves you a lot of time because you always want to go back and rehearse that funny spot where it was different from the first verse, you know. But I didn't tell him, but I love the chord sheets, you know.
Who was the first person you ever saw use the number system, Al?
It was Neil Matthews. But Charlie McCoy and I have a disagreement because I thought
Neil
there
Matthews was... Neil Matthews was one of the Jordanaires.
Okay.
Yeah, we'd walk by and there'd be this big, tall, yellow sheet of paper. And I thought my memory was it was like Roman numerals, 1, 2, 3, IV, V5. But Charlie had it in Arabic or something in his book. I talked to him about it, and I'm not sure. He was the first one that used a number system. But that was for the singers. And then one day I was a leader on a session at the Quonset Hut, and everything stopped. And I'm looking around to see what's happening. Charlie's down on his hands and knees talking to Wayne Moss, one of the guitar players. And I go and see what's happening, you know. And Wayne had a pad this big. And Charlie says, we're writing this down in numbers. I said, okay. And I walked off. And Charlie was the first one that really introduced the number system, you know. Wow. And people write it differently. And let them write it whichever way is best for them to read it.
Well, I use it in New York. I use it on Daryl's TV show sometimes.
The guys are okay.
No, I mean, sometimes I will, but I use it if I have to cheat and learn stuff really quick. I still use it. It's just ingenious system.
It actually really works well.
Yeah.
Oh, listen, it saves you time.
And I'll never get rid of these charts. I've had them for 20 years, Harold. These are all I've got. So many. Everything.
Look at these.
Slim's old set list. I've got Slim's contract he first gave me, the union contract. Wow. You know, here's...
Well, I have all of Slim's charts at home.
Deal for Jackpot Nevada.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
I even have a little list where I had charged a toothbrush and something to my room because it got lost or something, and Slim sent me a bill for like $7 for incidentals. Saved it.
Slim.
Yeah, it's so great.
Actually, there is one more thing I'd like to bring up. Harold is talking about how Chet Atkins helped so many people. Harold has helped a lot of people, too. I met Harold when I first moved to town, and he absolutely mentored me, helped me get gigs, taught me the ropes.
Wow.
And I know he did that for a lot of other guys.
He tried to do it for me. I remember, Harold, I don't know if you remember, you tried to get me on this TV show here in Nashville. I was so green back then. But I really appreciate that, you know, and Andy. The reason I know you is because of Andy, you know.
Well, I thought I was Andy's mentor, but now he's my mentor. He's tearing it up. He's playing better than anybody in Nashville, man.
He's great. I mean, he's a great player.
He's playing anything he wants to play with a beautiful tone. Beautiful tone, but it's a great ear. Great ear.
Absolutely.
He's getting where he's like Hank Garland. You play him a lick and he'll play it back at you. That's what Chet said.
All right, there you have it, folks. I'm sorry we got a little cut off there. It was a little abrupt. Andy had to go to a recording session and had a cable come unplugged or something happened. But anyway, that was what went down that day. And thank you, Harold, again for sitting down and chatting, and Andy, and I hope you enjoyed this one. As always, I love your comments, your ratings on iTunes. Really enjoy that. Thank you so much. Hope you keep listening. I'll keep doing it as long as you guys keep listening. Thanks for tuning in.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.